Frank, you were saying that we were talking about the B-29, the Air Force B-29 that crashed near Kotzebue.
This was quite close to the Arctic Circle in the middle of the Seward Peninsula. I think the name of the mountain range is the Midnight Mountain, and they hit the base of this mountain full power, and the airplane broke apart after they had slid along the snow there for a ways and broke off one wing, and then the plane caught fire, and the crew all got out, all 8 members of the crew, and then I understand one of the crew members dove back into this burning fuselage and got out a couple of parachutes and 2 or 3 sleeping bags and a little bit of emergency grub, threw it out. He was burned to some extent in the rescuing this stuff, but it undoubtedly saved the lives of all of them there, as all the plane and the motors and the oil and gasoline all burned, leaving a great big smudge on the snow because the wind was blowing at about 40 miles an hour at the time of this crash. These men then were up there several days before the crash was ever spotted from the air. Of course, the military had a late fix of them. They knew when they passed over Kotzebue, and they were able to send search planes to the general area where they were last reported from. But due to the ground storm and the drift that continued to last for several days, they did not succeed in spotting this downed aircraft till about 4 days had passed. In the meantime, the crew had taken quite a beating because of the extreme cold and extreme high wind, and some of them were injured to some extent, and they were frostbitten and in a pretty bad way. They finally got a location on them, and another pilot who was flying out of Nome at the time, Bill Munns, he and I were successful in getting in there and landing under very difficult conditions, high wind and poor visibility on the side of this mountain. And we were able to bring out 6 that remained there, the survivors. The pilot and the navigator attempted to walk out to a village which would have been 50 to 60 miles away, but they only got 4 miles out before they froze, and we later found them there. But this was one of the highlight rescue missions that I had taken
part. Well, describe to me just briefly how you landed on the side of the mountain with these storm conditions.
Well, the visibility, as I say, was very, very poor. We were able to get the location of the plane, and we wanted to land as close as we could. It was on the lee side, or the downwind side, where the wind had struck this very abrupt bluff, and so it was very turbulent on the approach. Several times I thought the airplane was going to wind up on its back as I was trying to approach this area for a landing, but we did manage to get in there and land within about 500 feet of the crash site. The angle of the hillside was probably 20 degrees or greater slope on it, and we immediately had to cover up our engines. We walked back over to the crash site, and believe me, the survivors there were quite surprised to see someone there that had succeeded in getting in to pick them up. And we then had to, after we loaded them back in the plane, one of them had a busted leg, and we had to help them, and some of the others were in a bad way. You have to taxi the airplane quite fast, almost to get it going in a downhill position, and then to get enough speed to make a turn back uphill. And we were able to taxi in a salaaming fashion to get up to the top to crest this mountain that we were on, and practically taxied over the top of this mountain into the wind. There was sufficient updraft as we fell over the side of this bluff that we became airborne and were able to bring the people on back into Nome. As a result of this, Carl Spatz, who was then chief of the Air Force, and came up with a special commendation, and
for you and for Bill Munns?
For Munns and myself, and we were awarded the Air Medal by Harry Truman at the time for our assistance on this rescue.
And were you awarded the citation and the medal in a special ceremony in Fairbanks?
Yes, they had the ceremony in Nome.
In Nome.
And they
mm-hmm.
Came up from Anchorage to award the medals to us there.
Well, you flew then, actively flew for Wien until about 1951.
Yes.
And then I know you and your wife have done a great deal of public relations work for Wien. Neva, could you talk just a little bit about that? I know you're an important part of this Whaley team.
Well, I don't know. Well, right after this crack-up, I'll go back a little bit, of the Army plane, and Frank, in the rescue part, had to roll the window down so that he could try to see through the drifting snow, and it was very cold, barely cold, and the muscles and nerves in his neck got pretty badly frozen. So he was off flying for almost a year, I guess, and his neck condition just didn't improve at all, so we had to go stateside to try to get some help. And it was just a long process of healing. And that kind of put an end to the flying for a while, but then we came back after he was getting along all right. And I guess you could take it from there, Daddy, what you did.
Well, we went back to our mining a while. We mined for a couple of years after that. And then I went back to work for Wien. Before I went to work for Wien, though, at that time, I went in as the managing director of the Alaska Visitors Association for 2 years.
Oh, I see.
And
that's how you broke into the tourism business.
Yes, to quite an extent. And then we lived in Anchorage for part of that time, and also in Juneau part of the time.
In the meantime, we'd had two children that were born in Nome, a girl, Nina, and our youngest son, Lon, and Brownie, our oldest son, was born in the States before we came
north,
yeah. But we had our three children with us then.
So when you made this historic stopover in Nulato, Brownie with you.
No, we didn't bring Brownie because we didn't know what we were going to face going to Alaska.
A good thing we didn't. And came up on the first boat in the spring. We came up in the fall. He came up on the first boat with some friends.
Frank's mother looked after him outside.
Yeah, my mother looked after him.
He was Brownie was born in Seattle then.
Yeah, he was born in Seattle, but the other two children were born in Nome.
And where are your children now?
Well, at present, Nina is in Alyeska, and her husband, Chris von Imhoff, is manager of the Alyeska Ski Resort, and they have a home there, and she has her own dog team, enjoys that very much. She's heard us talk so much in the past about our dog team that we had in Nome. I think that kind of spurred her on to getting one of her own. And Brownie, at the present time, is the Anchorage manager for Fairbanks Air Service, and he's doing a lot of flying. And Lon, our youngest son, is at the present time, he's at Alyeska too. He's working there.
Nina is married. Is Brownie married?
Yes, Brownie's married and has two little boys.
Nina
has two little boys. Lana's unmarried yet. We have one more to go.
Yeah. But you said that you were the, to get back to Frank and the tourism. You were the managing director of the Alaska
Visitors Association.
Visitors Association.
At the time, right at the time when it was first formed. And then this was keeping us apart virtually all the time, since I was traveling all over the state and then stateside promotional work, so we decided to break away from that, and I then went to work for WEAM in charge of their tour program. That was in 1957.
Well, in the meantime, maybe you should follow through a little bit on your experiences in the legislature when you were flying for WEAM.
Yeah, this was some time prior to that. I served 4 years in the House of Representatives, Democratic ticket, and 2 in the Senate. This was when Governor Greening was governor of the state. And I knew Bill Egan quite well. He was in the House during one of these sessions that I was down there.
I'm sorry I didn't ask you about that, but I knew that you had been in the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we have many friends from all over the state, and have had a chance to get a little rounded out phase of all the different types and areas, and lived in the Arctic. We lived at Kotzebue for a while. I was station manager there for WEAM for a couple of years.
That's when they were first starting their tours into the Arctic, just beginning. So we were in on the...
I think you're the instrumental man in the Nome Kotzebue Eskimo dancing and the tourism.
Well, to quite an extent, we took a very active part there in developing a program that we felt would please and satisfy the visitors, and finally have the programs worked up to where they became very well received. And since that time, there have been a great many people that have gone into the Arctic for vacation. Chuck West first started flying tour groups over there. He was a pilot for WEAM at the time we was flying for them also. And he started flying multi-engine planes into the Arctic with tourists there. But my brother Jack, who was vice president for WEAM, and Chuck West and myself were all involved quite heavily in developing tour programs into the Arctic. And Chuck West and Jack and I went to Barrow. This would be in about 56, I guess, or 7, to check out the tour possibilities up there. It seemed very unlikely that we could ever get anything going, but they finally have come up with a very good tour program in the Barrow area now, and they're doing quite well with it.
Are you associated with WEAM at the present time?
No, only as a retiree. I retired in September 2 years ago, and we do, of course, keep our contacts there very close, but that is the only procedure. I worked 15 years here in Kotzebue as their tour manager and their interline.
You mean Fairbanks?
Out of Fairbanks.
During that time, Neva and I had an opportunity to visit many places in the world. I represented WEAM Airlines at the various travel conventions. They usually take in all the annual travel conventions. That ASTA, the American Society of Travel Agents, have. They have each year what they call a World Travel Congress, at which there's 3,000 to 4,000 travel agents and tour operators from all over the world have this conference. They have those in different parts of the world. One year it'll be in Rome, and next in Hong Kong, and different parts of the country. Occasionally they have them in the States, so we have been fortunate in being able to attend these conferences in many different parts of the world. And
name some of the places you've been on these.
Mexico City and Athens and
Paris,
Tokyo, Paris,
Norway, Copenhagen,
yeah.
Australia.
What about Southeast Asia, India, or any place they've been
no,
in?
No, they have not had one that I know of in there. They had them in Hong Kong and Tokyo.
But for 15 years, you were the Ween Airline
tour manager. Yeah, this was this capacity. Outlined, set up the tours, and hired their tour guides, and determined what schedule and what type of an operation we would have.
But in that capacity, you also did interline publicity and public relations work.
And during the winter months, after our tour season had wrapped up, and we had this was another one of my duties, was to write the copy for the tour folders, determine what type of an operation we would have, and the pricing of the tours. And then I would go stateside to get our tour folders made up and make travel agency calls, primarily sales calls, interesting agents in selling the Ween tours. And which time, during that time, I did a great deal of promotion work on TV, radio, and lecture work across the states, and showing slides and movies. It was partly because of the demand there that we started taking a great many photographs to have material that would properly publicize the state, and particularly the Arctic, the area that we were featuring.
I was going to get on to the photography subject here in a minute. You've taken some really outstanding promotional pictures, and I know just for Alaska use and Alaska publications, but also outside use. When did you start photography?
Well, actually, we started.
Did you fall into it, or
we started by accident, it in '35, really, in Nome. We were so fascinated with all the new life and taking pictures. We had our own dog team and wanted to make a good record of that, and we started taking quite a few pictures at that time, and not only still pictures, but movies. We had our first little 8mm movie camera that we got, and we now have over 16 hours of showing time of 8mm movies depicting all the different things that we have done up here. And then later started taking commercial pictures in 16mm, and have altogether have filmed and produced 16 motion pictures on Alaska, total of that number, in that have been used commercially. And one of these movies, the last big one that we worked on, has now been made into a feature-length motion picture called The Legend of Amalek. It's an hour and 45-minute feature film blown up to 35mm for theatrical use. Lauren Green does a narration on it, and I'm sure it will be getting up here to Alaska one of these days. It's now being shown in Europe. The company that was involved with the production of it sold the rights to the European market, and it's being shown there, and is scheduled to open in Seattle September the 26th. And we're in hopes that it will come on up here to Alaska this fall.
But besides movies, you've taken numerous, thousands probably, black and white pictures and,
black and white
color
and
slides,
color
photos.
Transparencies.
In
and
fact,
these,
I picked up a visitor's guide yesterday, and I think there was a picture of yours on the cover of that.
Yes, that picture of the big jade boulder at Kotzebue. Yes, we've had terrific coverage of our photos, and they have been used quite extensively. The material, I turned a lot of it over to the Alaska Division of Tourism, and they have used these pictures, and are yet, for that matter, using quite a number of them in the material they supply to schools and to various publications stateside. we thoroughly enjoyed our photography and still do quite a little of it. Neva is doing quite a little picture work now, particularly, and has for the past few years. We were in Tokyo here about 3 years ago and bought some new equipment over there, and she's thoroughly enjoying her use of that.
Yeah.
Do you do any of your own developing work?
No, we haven't gone into that.
We never seem to be in one place long enough or have had the facilities. We usually are on the go pretty much.
Now this color picture on your wall, is that one of your shots?
Yes, that's one of our pictures. It's one that Neva particularly likes, the showing the action of the seal hunters of pulling in the large bearded seal, the Ugruk, on the beach at Kotzebue. Got a lot of action to it.
But you got into the photography just to record your own life,
that's true,
your children and your family life.
From then on, it's been a matter of learn it as you go along and the trial and error procedure. But I was particularly taken up with the Eskimo life that existed when we first came up here. Of course, this has greatly changed now, and filmed a pretty good record of what takes place in all the different villages and stuff that would no longer be available, this type of thing. And these have worked out into a most interesting series of pictures, that short documentaries on Eskimo life.
Mm-hmm. I noticed a vast difference at Barrow. I lived up there 5 years totally, and first went in 1950. And there wasn't much to do at I lived at the camp, not at, mm-hmm. at Barrow Village. And I went to several of the whale camps and took colored slides.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know how valuable those were. To me, they're valuable.
Yeah.
Maybe
mm-hmm.
not to anyone else. But at that time, it was dog team. You walked out to the whale camp, or you took a dog team, or if you were lucky enough to catch a dog team. And they would put a flag up on the high piece of ice to
depicting
alert the village. Alert the village. Now, I'm in May, just a month before last month, I was in Barrow, and I went to a whale camp. They now have walkie-talkies at the camps, and they get on the walkie-talkies every hour on the hour to, up and down the ice.
To alert
if there are any whales coming. And then there's someone back in Barrow Village who has her radio on 24 hours a day, and they call that home base, they call Igloo One. So Igloo One, anyone in town who wants to know, rings her up on the phone, and Igloo One tells her who's got a whale or if anyone has been sighted. And there's not a dog team at all. It's all snowmobiles.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a vast difference. Of course, a lot of it's still the same, the Umiak and the whaling weapons.
The technique
actual,
there.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. But this is very true. I was there the day before yesterday at Barrow, and Al Hobson was having his whale feast. I guess it's to be the last one of the season. And I went over there a little while, I guess it was right around their noon period, and they were feasting there at the time. But the old days, they used to use upturned umiaks and get through shelter, and now they all have different colored parachutes that they rig up for shelter for the wind, green and red and blue and the types. The people were all having dinner, but for the music, they had a tape recorder going, playing back their Eskimo songs and Eskimo dance music, and half the kids were running around on these little motorized three-wheel scooters, and as you say, it's just very difficult to believe how fast the change is taking place. That's why I'm pleased that I had the opportunity. I filmed a real good whale feast at Point Hope under fairly primitive conditions yet, with the native clothing that they were wearing at the time. You don't see too much of that anywhere out in the sticks anymore.
They're very innovative people, and they're quick to pick easier ways of doing things, and I can't blame them. There are some beautiful dogs in Barrow now. I noticed the couple of German shepherds were tied up near homes as watchdogs.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when I lived up there, the dogs were the means of transportation.
That's
there
right.
wasn't a snow machine around. The closest thing to a snow machine was a weasel, you know, tractor vehicle.
Yeah.
So
it's been a real fast transition in just comparatively few years. It's all taken place.
Well, some of your pictures I've seen on postcards. Have you done a lot of work in that?
Yes, we have, and we used to have so many requests for copies of our material, and everybody wanting us to get one of this made for them and this, and I finally gave up on trying to keep tab of it, and I turned them all over to Neva and said, you take them and run with them any way you want to go. So she has been... come up with a company that she formed, Arctic Circle Enterprise, and sells these postcards, colored photos, and also colored slides, transparencies. And they are available throughout the state now at all the various shops, the airports and curio shops, and you see a lot of that material now being used. And
well, I've seen some of your slides then.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I'm sure you have.
Mm-hmm. Seen a lot of them there. They have them at all the stores.
What are your plans now? You're retired from active work with Ween. Are you still associated with them in any way?
No, not in no capacity other than that we use the service as a retiree. We are privileged to use the airline to go to any of their points, and we do quite a little traveling and photography sessions when we go out there. Europe, Nome, Kotzebue just recently. But we are thinking in terms of going back out at our mine here. We're going to go definitely this summer for a while, and then possibly next year spend quite a little time out there with the price of gold up where it is now.
Yeah.
$100 or more an ounce, three times of what we used to get
Sounds
for.
Sounds pretty attractive.
Why,
Well, will you have to hike in over the Niggerheads this time, or
well,
do you have an airstrip there
We
now?
Do have an airstrip there, such as it is. It's pretty well grown over with willows, but we can get in and out of it. You have to take a high-performance airplane to get in and out of it, and we will either fly in, or we are considering the possibility of taking one of these little recreational type vehicles, that all terrain vehicles, and they've got a road now that we could take 90 miles, drive 90 miles north of Nome on this road, and then take to the tundra there with something, one of the track type light vehicles to drive in, so that we'd have some transportation there at the mine. We sold virtually all of our equipment. We used to have three tractors in there, and we sold those after we quit mining, and but we have been going in each year to do our assessment work and keep up the ground there and do a little prospecting. And, it sounded like something that we would thoroughly enjoy, and we would break away then for the winter cold part, but go up there in the spring and be there most of the summer.
So now in the winter time you go where it's a little warmer, is that right?
We have been, yeah. Last winter we... turned out this book on Chester Seelig, a book called The Legend, no, his book was The Longest Reindeer Herder. And this Chester Seelig was one of the fellows who has worked for me as a guide at Kotzebue for many, many years. But I had met him back in 1935 when he had a large reindeer herd up in the Arctic. He's in charge of a government herd of 5,500 deer, and I filmed two different movies out there in his herd. One called The Keepers of Santa's Reindeer, and the other one was The Nomads of the North. So I became quite well acquainted with Chester, and during staying at his camp for several weeks, he told me the story of his life, and I prevailed upon him to, that someday, write all this up so that we might consider putting in a story or book form. And this past winter he got the material to us, and Neva and I put this little booklet out, and it's also available now at all the various bookstores and a number of curio stops, The Longest Reindeer Herder. It's a real fascinating little book on his experiences.
It's his own experiences. That's and right. Your photographs.
Yeah. There's about 60 our pictures in the book, and his telling it just the way he talks and just the way he lived it. I'm real pleased that we were able to get that while Chester's still around.
How old is Chester now?
He's 83 years old.
He's still dancing, though, isn't
he? He's still dancing. He's still working there at Kotzebue this summer as a tour guide.
Amazing.
He seemed to go on and on forever, doing a real good job. His wife, Helen, is also with him there. Yeah. They now have, I think, 137 grandchildren, 34 great-grandchildren.
137?
Mm-hmm.
Grandchildren? 34 great-grandchildren.
But I think anyone that's interested in really getting a look-see at how it was in the old days, particularly, would enjoy reading this book of his, The Longest Reindeer Herder. As he starts it out, where he was born, Kivalina, 1890, and runs right up to the present time, and gives you a real good idea of what this all has taken place in the transactions.
Does he keeps it on the subject of reindeer herding, does he? Or
yes,
does he get into
pretty
his
much.
Tourism
adventures?
Not so
much, a great deal of reindeer herding, but he does branch off in telling about his first trips to the States and some of these promotion trips that we've been on. Mm-hmm. We've had him to Japan and Mexico and all over the States, and he tells some of his experiences there that are quite comical of his first getting used to the stateside.
Well, I think we've covered
a lot of ground,
and I've taken up your whole evening.
Well,
so
it's been
I really do
very
appreciate
enjoyable.
Talking with both of you.
Well, we enjoyed it too. We forgot to tell that Nina was Miss Alaska.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When was she Miss Alaska?
1963.
I remember when she was.
Yeah.
I forgot the year.
Uh huh. Our claim to fame.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's a pretty girl.
Nobody would remember us, but they always remember Nina.
Yeah, wherever we go, people rush up to us and they say, "Oh boy, how's Nina?"
Whatever happened to your wire-haired terrier?